You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 23rd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme.
For almost 2 years, our opponents have used every trick in the book to block flights and keep the boats coming. But enough is enough.
The UK's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak finally gets a bill that will see illegal migrants sent to Rwanda. But could the courts still get in the way? After that, we'll have the business headlines. We'll look at the opening arguments of Donald Trump's first trial in New York. We'll explore whether German and British spies for China are just the tip of the iceberg. And finally,
TikTok access to 177 million American users makes it a valuable propaganda tool for the CCP to exploit.
We'll look at the future of TikTok under fire from US and European legislators. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. One of the world's more bizarre answers to illegal migration took one more step forward last night. A showdown in the British House of Lords ended with the passing of a bill that will see illegal migrants crossing into the UK sent for processing to Rwanda. The bill, which will be signed into law today by its champion, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, has long been criticised by human rights groups in the UK, and this week the Human Rights Commissioner of the Council of Europe joined in those condemnations, calling the bill a potential violation of the rule of law. The bill does still face court challenges, but none of this has deterred Rishi Sunak, who says flights will begin in the next 10 to 12 weeks. Well, joining me for more is the political journalist and author and regular Monocle contributor, Terry Stiassny. Terry, always great to have you on the show. Place this first, perhaps, in the context of other efforts to halt immigration. I mean, this one is bizarre for the sheer lengths that the UK is going in picking a country like Rwanda for processing.
I mean, yes, this is a process that the British government has been trying to get through for the past 2 years. And they came up 2 years ago and sort of a couple of prime ministers ago with the plan to try to send illegal migrants to Rwanda. They have also been trying to negotiate similar agreements with other countries. And they will point to the agreement that they have already with Albania to send people who come from Albania back there. So they are trying to take drastic measures, partly because of what they see as the continuing problem of migrants, particularly arriving in small boats across the channel in large numbers, and that is still continuing. So they're hoping that this scheme will operate as some kind of a deterrent to try and deal with this problem.
Why is Rishi Sunak convinced, I suppose, that this is the best way? I mean, to offshore migrants so far away rather than even closer to home. I mean, give me his best argument here.
I suppose his best argument is that he believes this ultimately is a deterrent. It will stop people wanting to come to Britain if they know that they can't even claim asylum in Britain, that they will end up being sent to Rwanda to have an asylum claim process from which there is no possible, you know, return to Britain after that. You can either have your asylum claim processed in Rwanda and stay there or be, you know, dealt with there. You can't then apply to come to Britain. He's hoping this is a deterrent. He sees this as something which is deeply unpopular, potentially with his voters. And what he was saying today is that he believes this is a fundamental change in the global equation on migration, and he thinks it will help to, in his words, break the business models of the criminal gangs who are largely responsible for smuggling people into the country.
So it might be a game changer as he's describing it, but then for exactly those reasons that you describe, particularly the fact that these migrants would be sent to Rwanda for processing, is why it is still in the crosshairs of the courts, isn't it? The fact that these flights are happening before an asylum claim is actually adjudicated, so we don't know if that asylum claim is legal or not. This is the Council of Europe's point, for example. I mean, what is the government's answer to that?
Well, the government's answer is that they have tried to draw up an agreement with Rwanda to say that this would be a safe country, that people would be fairly treated there. One of the big objections from the House of Lords yesterday was that just Britain saying that Rwanda is a safe country doesn't make it so. And so there are still many potential legal challenges. Once this bill is written into law and once the treaty with Rwanda is ratified, then people can be detained with this view to deporting them. But there could still be a lot of legal challenges. People could say that they could face severe harm in Rwanda, and that this is could potentially then go to the European Court of Human Rights. And just the logistics of making this work are still complicated. It could still take several months before we see people actually be deported. This may not happen before the summer. And Rishi Sunak had been promising for a while that, you know, he wanted to get this done as soon as possible.
So given the logistics, the court challenges, and also even just on the merits of this idea, crossings into the UK are, as you say, very high despite this Rwanda bill and this debate over the Rwanda bill. Do we imagine that the bill actually going through will have a real effect in deterring migrants?
Well, this is the really big question, particularly for Rishi Sunak. I mean, every time you see him talking about this, he did a press conference yesterday, and up on the wall behind him was the slogan, "Stop small boats." But then this morning, we heard of another terrible incident in the Channel where people possibly died, which were having to be rescued. So it will remain to be seen whether this deterrent effect works. And I think, you know, a lot of people will be looking at other ways to try and deal with it. I mean, Labour, the opposition, for instance, say that the Rwanda plan is, they call it an extortionately expensive gimmick. And they think that you need to deal with the problem of migrants further back along the line, but before people start getting into boats and try to prevent that. But this is something that Rishi Sunak has said he's promised to do, and it's made it one of his big objectives for his government as a whole. So politically, he really needs it to work.
Well, and on that politics, given that we are heading into or near an election in the UK as well, you mentioned Labour's arguments there and what they want to do. Tell me more about that, or how both sides are seeing this politically. The fact that we're discussing a plan like Rwanda, how has that sort of impacted the immigration debate in the UK?
Well, I think a lot of the debate in the UK has, you know, focused particularly on this issue of small boats. And there's no doubt that for some Conservative voters or people who voted Conservative in the past, this is a big issue, and it's something that they want to see stop happening and feel very strongly about, particularly also asylum seekers being put up in hotels while they wait for their claims to be adjudicated. Now, Labour says it's got an alternative plan, which is more to do with treating this as a crime, cooperating internationally and dealing with the gangs. But if you look at how long it has taken this government to set the scheme up, the question is, I think, for Labour, not only they're saying that they would dismantle this plan and take it apart, but how long and how much political capital will it use for them if they're in power to try and say what their alternative is? How can they make the asylum system work, given that, you know, people have plenty of strong feelings about it?
A reason perhaps that both sides will still be looking to the courts as well. Thanks very much, Terry. That was the political journalist Terry Stiassny. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The US is drafting sanctions that threaten to cut some Chinese banks off from the global financial system. The sanctions hope to stop Beijing's commercial support of Russia's military production. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken will visit Beijing and Shanghai later this week, with China-Russia trade high on the agenda. Police arrested dozens of people at pro-Palestinian demonstrations at Yale University in Connecticut and New York University in Manhattan yesterday, as the war in Gaza continued to reverberate through U.S. university campuses. The police crackdowns came after Columbia University cancelled in-person classes in response to protesters setting up tent encampments at its New York City campus last week. And Taiwan's government has pledged to remove almost 800 statues of Chiang Kai-shek, the controversial Chinese military dictator who ruled the island for decades under martial law. In 2018, the government established a transitional justice committee to investigate the rule of the former generalissimo, which recommended removing the statues. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. Now for the latest business headlines, I'm joined by Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, always good to have you on the show. We're starting with China and Apple. More problems there for the country.
Hi, Chris. Yeah, stocks have had a good start to this week in the green today after gaining yesterday. But the backdrop to all of this is a $2 trillion sell-off. It was a sell-off that's been concentrated among the big tech companies which dominate global stock markets. The so-called Mag 7 have had a rotten few weeks. Now, investors will be hanging their hopes on whether big tech will manage to meet some of the lofty expectations for artificial intelligence during this busy week of earnings season. Now, one of those so-called Mag 7 companies is Apple. And new data today shows that Apple's iPhone sales, at least in China, have been pretty poor, dropping 19% in the latest quarter. These are numbers from Counterpoint Research. Apple is now only the number three player in the Chinese smartphone market, and it's only a whisker ahead of fast-growing rival Huawei, which is in number fourth place. Now, the important question is, why were these sales so bad in the first quarter? The first quarter is an important time for shoppers in China. It's Lunar New Year, lots of people splashing out on new phones. So this sales drop of 20%, nearly 20%, is pretty bad. Huawei, by contrast, managed to grow sales by 70% over the quarter. China does remain Apple's second biggest market, but business there has got a lot harder after Beijing escalated its ban on foreign devices in state-backed firms and government agencies, really signaling its views of the tech giant. The company getting caught up in this war of words between the US and China, and consumers also embracing Huawei's return to prominence. It debuted that fancy new smartphone last year featuring a made-in-China chip, which US sanctions were supposed to prevent. So lots of headwinds for Apple in its second most important market. We'll get a wider picture of how Apple is doing generally around the world when they report their earnings next week.
Just to follow up on that quickly, Ewan, I mean, we'll be talking about TikTok later on in the show, but when it comes to Western companies in China, is this a trend as well? The fact that Apple is facing, you know, lower sales, is that something that we expect from other Western companies as well?
Well, I think Apple has been particularly hard hit because the competition in that market is so intense for smartphones, and the technology from these Chinese players, if you look at the list of the top 10 companies producing smartphones in China, most of them you probably would have never heard of, but there are all sorts of companies out there producing really quite decent smartphones. And the technology has really caught up. That's not to say that they are all as good as the Apple iPhone, but remember, that is a very expensive premium product. But many of these lesser known brands are producing really quite decent smartphones at a very low price, as you would expect from Chinese manufacturers. It's something that's also reflected in the EV market. We're expecting earnings from Tesla later on today. And they're also expected to be rather worse than analysts were forecasting. And a lot of that is because of competition from China. Chinese EV makers are just knocking out so many electric vehicles at such a low price. And again, Tesla has a premium position, but the pricing between a Tesla and some of the cheaper market competitors in China is just so huge.
Just one other story, Ewan, while we have you. Earnings is one aspect of this week. There's also the economic aspect, and we've had some good economic data from the euro area.
Yeah, private sector activity in the euro area is now at its highest level in almost a year. It's being buoyed by the services sector and Germany's return to growth. Now, this is the first reading of the PMIs for April. This is a survey we get every month, which is really our most up-to-date reading on the economy. Now, 50 is the reading, which marks the line between contraction and expansion. Across the euro area, it came in at 51.4. So that is a little bit of growth, not a great deal. And Germany managing to cross that 50 threshold for the first time since June. We talked before about how the German economy has been particularly hard hit with energy costs and their big manufacturing sector really struggling. And it is actually services which have been driving the growth. Manufacturing continuing to shrink across the euro area, though it is shrinking at a slower pace than before. Now, after contracting in the final quarter of last year, Germany was long expected to enter a shallow recession over the winter, but it does look like there's going to be some growth in the first 3 months of the year in the most important economy in Europe. That's because of a pickup in industrial production, exports and construction. So it looks like Germany will probably avoid that technical recession. Talking of technical recessions, good data also from the UK today. Its reading for the PMI came in at 54, so doing rather better than the euro area. That was up from just below 53 in the previous month. And that came in better than forecast. Again, it is being driven primarily by the services sector, manufacturing still mildly in contraction.
Ewan Potts, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. The world's attention has once again been focused on a courtroom in New York this week as Donald Trump's first criminal trial got underway with opening arguments yesterday, this one about whether Trump falsified business records by offering hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. It's arguably the least consequential of Trump's pending criminal trials, certainly the one with the least jail time, but since it is the only one that actually has a court date, it is the one we are all focusing on. Joining me from New York is the attorney and author Jamie Floyd. Jamie, great to have you back on the program. Tell us, first of all, just about the opening arguments yesterday. Did anything surprise you about the approach from either side?
Well, good morning. And as you say, Trump is making president with these 34 federal counts, 34 state counts in state court. He's got two federal trials and two state court trials, the first president with four cases in criminal court. That doesn't count, Chris, the civil cases that he's had to endure to this point, all since leaving office. And I would say, before I quickly answer your question about the opening statements, or I guess this is an answer, the opening statements really revealed that this case is not as much about hush money as we had all thought. It is really about election interference. And the prosecution really underscored that in their opening statement. Prosecutor Matthew Colangelo works for Alvin Bragg. Alvin Bragg is the New York district attorney who's bringing this case. And he really said to this jury, you've heard hush money, but that's not what this is. This is an election interference case because former President Trump's actions denied the American people in 2016 the ability to get all the information about their candidate. That's pretty much a quote. And that was a surprise. There will be testimony about the hush money payments, but they're focusing on the election interference. The other side, another surprise here, Todd Blanche, the lead attorney for Mr. Trump, used a very interesting phrase that everyone's been talking about all night long. Quote, there is nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It is not a crime. It's called democracy. And they went as far, Chris, to say that Trump is innocent and they're going to prove it. He's not just not guilty, which, as you know, Chris, in our system, not guilty is all you have to get with a jury, but they're going to try and show that he's innocent. So a couple of surprises there in the opening statements. It was a very compelling day. Mr. Trump alert, very alert for the first time since this business started.
It was a compelling day. And just the way that you phrase both sides there, Jamie, I think what's maybe fascinating about this is that, you know, arguably both sides are not really necessarily denying what happened here, are they? Both are kind of admitting that these payments happened. Even this idea that the National Enquirer was involved in hiding stories that could have damaged Donald Trump. We'll be hearing from the former publisher, David Pecker, more today as the first witness. But the whole question rests kind of on, is this kind of interference criminal? Is that, I mean, that's what this comes down to, right? What is your sense of whether it is or not?
Yes, that's a very astute observation. This is not a debate about the facts so much as it is a debate or question of Donald Trump's intent when he made 34 payments to the now famous or infamous Michael Cohen, who was his lawyer or his fixer. And what prosecutors alleged, and they cleanly alleged it yesterday in their opening statement, is that these three men in August of 2015 had a meeting, David Pecker, Donald Trump, and Michael Cohen, and conspired at that meeting, formed a conspiracy to influence the 2016 election. And prosecutors say they knew what they were doing and that when Donald Trump made his payments to his fixer, those were the hush money payments, and he intended to essentially defraud the American people. to influence the election in a way that is illegal in our system. But the Trump defense says, no, he did not. He was simply paying his lawyer. Everyone pays their lawyer. This was a retainer. And these were simply payments made to his lawyer. He didn't know what the lawyer was doing. And most people who are running big companies and certainly running presidential campaigns can't be expected to know what every single person in their employ is doing. He was just making his payments through his accountant and to his lawyer. And so that's what they're going to hinge the whole thing on. So you're absolutely right. It's not an argument about whether or not this happened. It's an argument about what Donald Trump knew and when he knew it.
And we're going to be hearing from Michael Cohen, of course, as well. But I wanted to ask you about a different aspect of this, Jamie, and that's kind of Trump's use of social media and the gag orders. I just wonder what your take is there as well. How far can prosecutors and the judge in this case kind of go if Donald Trump continues to violate the orders there?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because today, before we even begin testimony, David Pecker, as you indicated, will be back on the witness stand. He only testified for a short time yesterday because of the Jewish holiday Passover. The judge is holding half days this week, and he'll be back on the stand. But Chris, before anything happens, there will be a hearing again on whether Donald Trump has violated the gag order yet again. And the prosecutors are asking for $1,000 per violation, so for every time he has violated the gag order, specifically this time for statements he's made about Michael Cohen. And he could face possible jail time, Chris, if he does not stop the violation of the gag order. Now, to be fair, as you point out, social media is really the crux of the problem. And Trump's lawyers asked for this hearing because they want, one, they want a gag on Michael Cohen because he's out there talking and there's no gag order on him. But also they want clarity about what exactly speech is in this case. If Donald Trump reposts something that someone else says on social media, will Judge Mershon count that as a violation of the gag order? So there's going to be a hearing this morning. It will be very contentious, I'm sure. And the transcripts of everything will be released at the end of the day. So even though we don't have a camera in there and we can't see it in real time, we will be able to very well understand what went down by about 2 o'clock today.
Jamie Floyd in New York, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. Last week on this show, we covered the case of two German Russians accused of spying and sabotage on Russia's behalf. This week, it is the turn of China to be in focus. Three people have now been arrested in Germany in two separate cases involving allegations of spying for China. One scheme reportedly sought to extricate sensitive technologies from German universities. Another involves a staffer for the far-right Alternative for Germany. And here in the UK, two people have also been charged with spying for China, including one parliamentary researcher for the Tories. Joining me now is Isabel Hilton, founder of China Dialogue and visiting professor at King's College London's Lau Institute. Isabel, always great to have you on the show. Let's start with Germany here. What did you make of the allegations there? And is this the tip of the iceberg?
I think it may be. I mean, I think all of these cases are illustrative of the breadth of China's efforts, both in intelligence gathering and in influence. And China's noted for doing things on a very large scale. So if you recall, there was the recent revelation about the data breach at the Electoral Commission, where pretty much the details of every voter in the UK had been hoovered up. And there have been kind of similar things in the US. In terms of their human intelligence, again, it's dual purpose. Some of it is about extracting useful information, including military and security information. And universities are a favorite target because you can set up joint research programs, you can gain access to kind of advanced thinking in very serious universities, and that's all very useful. Many of those universities have contracts themselves with the military establishment, so that's a way in. And as far as the AFD European candidate goes, that's a classic influence operation, unusually for the far right. This man, Maximilian Krah, is noted for being a real friend of China. He repeats Chinese propaganda lines all the time. And his assistant, all we know about his name is that he's called Jian, which is a Chinese name, it would appear, has been influential in both feeding back what's going on in the European Parliament, which is a real concern to China because Europe's its biggest market and there are divisions in Europe about how to deal with China, but also in propping up a man who is acting as a kind of, as what Lenin would call a useful idiot.
It is pretty extraordinary when you put it that way. I mean, what did we know also about the cases then here in the UK? How serious are those?
Well, those cases are curious. Again, you've got an influence come intelligence gathering one in Christopher Cash, who was a relatively low-level parliamentary researcher, but he was attached to the Foreign Affairs Committee. Now, that's kind of important because the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee is pretty robust on China, and they've produced some pretty robust reports. So that's helpful. He had no access to any classified information, and he had relatively little direct contact with the MPs themselves, but nevertheless, in a position to collect information, if that's what he was doing. The second character is a complete mystery. He's called Christopher Berry, and he's been described as a professor, but there is no affiliation, and you don't really get to be a professor without an institution at which you are professoring. So it's very odd, and there is confusingly a Christopher Berry, who is an expert on China, on Chinese cinema, as it happens, at King's College London's Lao Institute, where I'm also affiliated, but it's not him. So what is publicly known about the mysterious Christopher Berry is very, very little. These two were arrested last year, and there has been quite a long pause between their being arrested, and obviously Christopher Cash lost his job at that point in Parliament, and these charges, which I guess we'll learn more about the detail of those when they do come up in court, which is quite soon now.
I do imagine your colleague Christopher Berry will be getting a lot of requests whether that he's actually the one named or not. But Isabel, I did want to ask you to sort of broaden this out a little bit. What is your sense of whether this is business as usual, I suppose, for China, particularly this human intelligence aspect that we also spoke about last week when it came to Russia? Would we expect China to be doing basically this for much of the past decade, or are these cases of some kind of different character?
I think they've been doing them for the past decade. It's become much more animated under Xi Jinping. There's a really important part of the Communist Party, which is called the United Front Work Department, and their job is to neutralize hostile elements or non-affiliated elements. So it starts off in China with organizations of influence which are not connected to the party. So you don't want them messing up or competing with the party for attention. So you have this operation which effectively neutralizes them. It either co-opts them or it disables them. And in the last decade, this has gone abroad. So there is a whole United Front Work Department operation, which is global, which seeks to identify people who could be useful idiots and to neutralize those who are hostile. And this is very much human intelligence. This is, you know, the kind of information that Christopher Cash would have had access to. It doesn't strike me as critical to national security, but it is critical to China's diplomatic effort. You know, they want to neutralize critics. In Europe, they've just had rather a success with the visit of Scholz, the German chancellor, who seems to have deviated from the more robust line that Brussels was taking. And that's really important to China. So absolutely, business as usual, but on a much broader scale. And unusually, we're getting much more pushback from the target countries than we did. You know, for a long time, target countries would sort of stay quiet. They might try and confront China behind closed doors, but going public had the risk of retaliation, and relations were sufficiently robust that people didn't want to do that. But that, I think that time is over. Now, when people are discovered, they're very much made public in the attempt to embarrass China, to expose what China's up to. China then vigorously denies it, says it's all invented, and we are at another stage of the standoff.
Times have changed. Isabel Hilton, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, finally, on today's show, among the four foreign aid bills passed by the U.S. House of Representatives over the weekend was a provision that could see the social media site TikTok banned in the United States if its Chinese owners don't sell their stake in the company. It is just one of many challenges facing the popular social media site. EU regulators have also given TikTok a 24-hour deadline to answer mental health concerns about a new version of its app. Well, joining me for more is Josh Cowles, a consultant and writer about technology policy and a Monocle Radio regular. Josh, welcome back to the show. Let's start with the ownership question for TikTok. This isn't new, but it is coming to a head right now, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, TikTok is under major pressure, particularly on its parent company, ByteDance, to sell, as you say, its Chinese-based shares in the company amid a crackdown that's been launched by the U.S. Congress. That bill is currently, as we speak, under consideration in the Senate. I don't think there's any doubt that it's going to pass. And so that will mean that potentially when that goes into effect, TikTok and its owners will have a very stark choice to make between either selling their shares in the parent company or seeing it banned from the U.S. altogether. So a major challenge for the app. Obviously, the U.S. is its largest market, and that clearly poses some rather existential problems, I think, for the app going forward.
And what is your sense of how much this Chinese stake actually matters? I mean, we heard at the top of the show from the U.S. Congress about this being, you know, about propaganda, the 177 million users of TikTok in the United States. Is there sort of evidence of Chinese propaganda on the site, or is this more just about the data itself?
I think this is mainly founded on fears about what could be done rather than what is necessarily already being done to affect the opinions of, as you say, the many millions of users of TikTok in the US. It is a wildly popular app. It's the only really large app that is owned and operated by a company that isn't based in the US. And that inevitably has raised concern. Now, those have taken two main forms. One is manipulation, as you say, particularly with the presidential election coming up later this year. And the second is the idea, at least in theory, that user data could be compromised and handed to the Chinese government if required by the government under laws that are in place in that country. So between the data on one side and the algorithms on the other, I think there is a real threat that the US sees, although I think it's mostly founded more in national security than potentially in other problems such as addiction and mental illness, which obviously are potentially problems that affect other American-owned apps as well.
Well, and we'll get to the mental illness aspect in a moment. But just before that, do you expect TikTok to actually comply with this? Could ByteDance divest itself of those Chinese shares in, say, the US, but not in Europe or entirely?
I think it's unlikely. I mean, the words coming from China are that will not happen. They're not willing to give up that stake. China has a so-called golden share, 1% golden share of ByteDance, and it's going to be very unlikely to relinquish that. It also put what seemed to be export controls on TikTok's algorithm just a couple of years ago, suggesting the value at stakes on TikTok's recommendation algorithm. So I think it's very unlikely that that would happen, which explains why the company's fought so hard against this act coming into place in the first place. But it seems to have run out of road on that legislative process. We imagine the bill will be going to President Biden's desk in the coming days, given the urgency of other provisions in that bill regarding aid to Ukraine. So I think, unfortunately, for ByteDance, it has very few options left. And it really is kind of uncharted waters, really, in terms of this major question about, is it possible for a non-US company, indeed a US adversary, to own and operate an app that is on the screens of so many millions of users, particularly young ones in the country?
Well, then, given the way you set that up, does that basically mean we are talking here about an app being used by 177 million Americans going to be banned in the next year? What will that do? TikTok is so hugely popular.
It's enormous. I mean, it's not without precedent. We have seen this take place in India, for example, and as alternatives do get developed. You know, clearly the IP that TikTok uses for its algorithm is very powerful, but other companies, of course, are catching up to that as well. But it will have a massive knock-on effect. You know, there's a whole economy of TikTok creators whose kind of livelihoods maybe are based on access through these apps. And it reflects the power that these kind of platforms, whether US, Chinese or other, really have on all our lives, both us as viewers who might be looking at the content and not be able to see it anymore, but also the creators who, as I say, rely on that. Interestingly, the political divide here is quite pronounced. It passed with a really comfortable majority of this bill, which suggests, as I say, that it's going to fly through the Senate as well. But already politicians are getting their excuses in early. Donald Trump, who threatened to ban the app when he was president, has taken to his own platform to remind particularly young voters that it was President Biden's fault for this app being potentially banned. Clearly trying to curry favor, I think, with the young voters who may be annoyed to see that. But TikTok's own efforts to persuade users to try to get on the phone with their representatives and stop the bans seem to have backfired when they undertook that effort a few weeks ago. So it is potentially unprecedented, at least in the US, but that doesn't mean it's any less likely to happen unless things change quite dramatically in the coming year.
Just finally, Josh, I do want to ask you quickly about the European Union as well, as we were talking about that the European Commission is focused on the mental health aspects of TikTok's app, or an aspect of its app that basically incentivizes people to watch more videos. I mean, this could all be moot if TikTok is banned in the United States next year. But just tell us about this and the mental health concerns.
Yeah, so this is the European Commission drawing on its powers in the Digital Services Act passed a few years back, which really reflects, I think, the European more procedural approach, let's say, to governing and regulating platforms compared to the more American shoot from the hip approach. The EU has these procedures in place designed to take effect anytime a large platform tries to launch a new service, which is what this is. And the service that TikTok has laid out here, as you say, incentivizes users to use the app more, to undertake video watching tasks. I think we can all see how that might end a bit badly, particularly as concerns are on the rise about things like screen time and effect on mental health. So I don't think the timing of this is particularly useful for TikTok, either because of the American efforts or because the EC already has an investigation in place looking at child safety on a platform. This feature isn't in theory able to be used by child users. It's only for adults. But I think it only ratchets up the pressure on TikTok on both sides of the Atlantic.
That was Josh Cowles. Thank you very much for joining us. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was Gunnar Grunlund. And our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Termek. Goodbye. And thanks for listening.